From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. This is Peter Sagal. Honestly, we were going to do a new show based on this week's news, but there's this new reality show on TV in which minor celebrities are asked to serve as Vice President of the United States, and the results are just hilarious. We could not tear ourselves away. So instead, here's a review of some of the best celebrity interviews we've done over the past year. Our interviews are different from the ones you'll see on late-night TV, for example, because those guys do the expected thing and ask questions the guest can answer. That's so 20th century, don't you think? We begin today with Neil Patrick Harris. He rose to fame as a child actor playing Doogie Howser, M.D., yet he seems strangely normal. We began by asking him if he tried, once Doogie Howser was canceled, to shake that goody-two-shoes image.
Yes, I've done a whole slew of made-for-TV telefilms where I was a serial arsonist. I hacked up my parents with a wood maul once. Good times.
Yeah. Really, so how did you get from, gosh, we need a fresh-faced young genius to, we need a psychopath, call Neil Patrick Harris?
I don't know, but I enjoy that aspect of a career.
You also
playing the regular, nice, average guy gets boring. It's fun to play the character roles.
I think of particularly your live theater roles. You played, for example, the very sort of sexually dangerous MC in that Broadway revival of Cabaret.
Of course, that was great.
Oh, I know. But in that situation, your fans can meet you. Did anybody come up to you and they're like, Doogie, how could you?
Some demented ones, yeah. No, the theater's been super helpful too. Doing a TV show is really exciting because lots of people get to see it, but it's a bit limiting because you're only sort of acting from the waist up all the time. So getting a chance to go and do Cabaret where you're stomping around and you'd be so full body with bruises and tattoos and being kind of naughty was really freeing for me at the time.
Yeah, that's why I'm dressed the same way right now.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm just wearing suspenders, no shirt. I've got lipstick on, eyeshadow.
Glitter on your nipples?
You bet. One of your more famous moments was your cameo in the movie Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
Yes.
And for people who haven't been lucky enough to see it, these two characters are trying to spend the whole movie trying to get to White Castle. And they're driving through New Jersey, I think. And there is Neil Patrick Harris. And they pick you up, and you're in their car, and you are crazed on ecstasy and desperate. I can't even quote you, of course, because this is public radio, to, shall we say, find some women now. So you're sort of this drug-addled, sex-crazed maniac.
Yeah, I steal
as yourself.
Car and go to a strip club.
Yeah. And now, did they propose this to you? They said, Neil, we want you to be yourself, but you'll be a drug-addled, sex-crazed, maniac lunatic? And you were like, great.
I heard through the grapevine that they'd written this movie and that I was in it and that I had to call my attorneys and make it stop, that it was a bad thing. And I read it and thought it was hilarious. It was...
Oh, really? So really, you first heard about, like, you know, Neil, we have to stop these people. They're defaming you. And you were
A friend was auditioning for a different part in the movie and said, do you know about this movie that you're in?
Well, what was their plan? They hadn't told you about it? Are they just going to hire somebody else to play Neil Patrick Harris?
No, I guess Fred Savage passed. There's a sequel coming out in a couple weeks, actually, where I'm on mushrooms this time.
That's great.
And take them to a house of ill repute.
I got to ask you about this. This is a famous incident in your career about 2 years ago. Some tabloids, some news were spreading rumors that you were gay, and you did this remarkable thing. You basically said to the world, yeah, I am, so what? And became really a hero to a lot of people, gay and straight, all around the world, just for being yourself, when that didn't seem allowed. And I wanted to ask, do you think of yourself as a pioneer in that way, as a hero? Because that's how a lot of people see you.
How dare you bring that up?
Peter, that was a huge mix-up, actually.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry.
I don't know. It was incredibly intense at the time because I was reading all of these things that I was apparently being quoted as saying, and it seemed a little witch-hunty. So I don't know. Well, it was kind of a non-issue to me at the time. And, you know, I had a boyfriend then, and we had been together for a while, so there was no real scandal. And all of a sudden, for me, it felt like my life was very scandalous, and that's what I wanted to avoid.
I got to say, it was kind of in the gay stereotype to say witch hunty. I just want to... I mean, we kind of knew then, I'm just saying. Well, Neil Patrick Harris, we're just delighted to have you with us, and we've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Excuse me, do you have Prince Albert in a can? Yes? Well, then, could you tell me what the heck that is?
It was April Fool's Day this week, of course, which meant we had to endure a series of pranks and gags in the news. For example, Hillary Clinton suggesting that she and Obama settle their nomination battle with a bowling match. Ha-ha. It turns out... that pranks and hoaxes, like everything else, aren't as good as they used to be. This week, we came across a list in the Times of London of the greatest hoaxers in British history. Answer 2 out of 3 questions about these hoaxes correctly. You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl Castle's hand in marriage.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's big stuff.
And don't get excited, Neil. It's for the listener.
Oh.
Carl, who is Neil Patrick Harris playing for?
Neil is playing for Ben Balser of Gonzales, Louisiana.
Ready to go?
I'm ready. I'm nervous.
All right. Now, this would be cool. You've handled worse than this. Here we go. One of the great pranksters of the 19th century in England was the author Theodore Hook. He was once insulted, or he thought so anyway, by a certain Mrs. Tottenham. So how did he extract his elaborate revenge? Did he A, hire someone to impersonate a cow on her farm, and then shock her into a faint when the cow spoke? B, did he arrange for wagon loads of coal, multiple pianos and shipments of furniture, and the Duke of Gloucester all to arrive at her house on the same day? Or C, did he put on a dress and wig and convince her that he was her long-lost daughter and live with her for a month before revealing the truth?
Wow. So I'm going to say C.
You're going to say C. No, the answer, in fact, was B. It was called the Berners Street Hoax. It was the mother of all, you know, pizza delivery gags. It took Mr. Hook 6 weeks to arrange, but on the same fateful day in 1809, dozens of carts filled with coal, furniture, pianos, pipe organs, and other merchandise showed up in Mrs. Tottenham's house, with payment due, of course. And at the same time, the Duke of Gloucester, the Lord Mayor of London, the Governor of the Bank of England, and the Chairman of the East India Company all showed up as well at the door, expecting to meet somebody equally important.
Wow, that's right. A good one.
You have 2 more chances. Here we go. Mary Toft became briefly famous in the late 18th century in England for her amazing apparent ability to do what? A, give birth to a litter of rabbits. B, converse intelligently with shrubbery. Or C, remove her own head and carry it around in a basket.
I'm going to say C again.
Remove her own head and carry it around in a basket.
Come on, Peter, do me right.
Sadly, the answer was A. She gave birth to a litter of rabbits.
What?
It's true. It's unclear why Mrs. Toft decided to pretend she had given birth to the first rabbit, but the attention she got made her keep doing it. Oh. She produced a total of 17 rabbits, some of them, quote, born under the supervision of some credible, if not particularly observant, physicians.
She must have been sleeping with Harvey.
Well, this is terrible.
Terrible. Well, you have 1 more chance here. Let's see if you can get something right. Another great prankster was Horace DeVere Cole. He was a friend.
Yes.
You know about him? He was a friend of Virginia Woolf's, early 20th century London. He enjoyed a reputation as a rake and a prankster. One of his great pranks was which of these? A, successfully pretending to be the American president Woodrow Wilson and getting a state banquet at the palace out of it. B, giving a group of bald men carefully selected theater tickets so their heads spelled out an obscenity when seen from above. Or creating, this is C, creating a fake fossil mermaid leading to speculation that humans evolved directly from fish.
Last one's boring.
Oh, excuse me, Mo.
I'm trying to help.
Tell me A again.
A was successfully pretending to be the American president Woodrow Wilson and getting a state banquet out of it. Because who knows what he looks like?
Yeah.
All right, I'll say A.
You're going to say A?
The bald thing is so fun.
The bald thing is so funny. Should I say B?
I don't know. It's not up to me.
At this point, just have fun. It doesn't matter.
That's why I'm already wrong.
What do you think?
Good point,
A or B?
I'll
A or
go B. I'm going to go B.
You're going to go B? You're right. That's what he did. They had no idea what was going on, but if you were sitting up in the upper galleries looking down, you were apparently shocked. Carl, how did Neil Patrick Harris do in our quiz?
Neil needed at least two correct answers to win for Ben Balser, but he just had one correct answer.
Well, Neil, I'm sorry. I know, but it was great to have you on the show. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Neil Patrick Harris is one of the stars of How I Met Your Mother, which airs Mondays on CBS. You can also see him in the movie Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay. Neil Patrick Harris, thank you so much. What a great guy. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Peter Sagal. Single best thing about my job, I get to talk to people I've always admired. I mean, in addition to Carl Castle. So it was a real thrill to interview novelist Stephen King, whose books comforted me as I grew up. I knew that as weird and horrifying as my own adolescence was, it could have been a lot worse. Strangely, Stephen denied having an unhappy childhood himself.
Everybody does that because there's sort of this unspoken subtext. What screwed you up?
Yeah, well, I didn't want to put it that bluntly, but maybe I should have just gone there.
Hey, listen, I've been around. This is my first rodeo. I'm used to that question.
Yeah, I can imagine. And what is your answer when that question is asked?
I just lie.
You just lie.
Yeah, sure.
What do you mean? Do you lie in the sort of the
Baroque? Well, no. I don't actually lie, but nobody believes the truth, which is I had a perfectly normal childhood.
Yeah.
And I just like scary things. It's part of the equipment.
Did you when you were a kid? Was that your thrill? Did you like scary books, scary movies? That was your thrill?
Sure. Yeah. I just read this wonderful book about the comics from the 50s, and that was what really warped my grooves, I would say, to begin with. Things like Vault of Horror and Crypt of Terror.
Oh, sure,
like
the
that.
Old EC Comics. That's
pre-code.
Do you think your mother waking you up with a cleaver had any kind of effect?
No, what happened was I read about the cleaver, and I woke her up. Can I get into bed with you? That's pretty Freudian right there.
Yeah, I guess so. However, I mean, speaking of your childhood, one of the things that drew me so much to your books when I was a kid, when I was sort of a geeky teenager, is that there were a lot of geeky teenagers in your books who either became the heroes and defeated the villain, or even more alluringly, gained supernatural powers and wreaked vengeance upon their many enemies.
Yeah, right.
We think of Carrie, we think of the lead character in Christine. So were you saying anything about your own high school years?
No, but I saw a lot in high school. I think everybody, first of all, everybody in high school feels like the geek. I always felt like if you are 10 years out of high school and you say, damn, those were the best years of my life, I don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah. They all end up being cops in the town they grew up with, so they're easy to avoid.
Wow.
Oh, Peter, you're going to get emails on that one.
Yeah, I know.
Not to mention traffic tickets.
Yeah, I know.
I'd take the bus from now on.
Well, Stephen King, we are delighted to have you with us. We have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
You're the warmest, fluffiest, most unthreatening friend ever.
So you've made your living frightening people, so we thought we'd ask you three questions about the people and things that were created to undo the psychic damage that you have wrought. Answer two of these three charming, lovely, kind questions, right? You'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice, on their home answering machine.
I hope your listener isn't pining for that prize.
No. I'm sure they don't care. Carl, who is author Stephen... I'm just trying to make him feel better.
I got you.
I'm just trying to lower the tension for Mr. King.
If only the radio listeners could see that single tear trickling down Carl's face right now.
All right, here we go. Carl, who is author Stephen King playing for?
He is playing for Laird and Diane Kentor from Houston, Texas.
All right, ready to play?
I'm ready to play.
All right, first question, we all remember Lamb Chop, the adorable puppet character, performed and voiced by Sherry Lewis. That's right. Lamb Chop. Ms. Lewis, although sweet and kind to everyone, mostly, had her peculiarities, including which of these? A, in private, she liked to vent her frustrations and anger with what she called a just-for-me puppet named Meat Grinder. B, whenever she went out to eat, she liked to order lamb chops, rare, just to horrify the waiters. Or C, sometimes she would suddenly hit or pinch the person standing next to her and say, sorry, but Lamb Chop told me to do that.
Well, the one that's the most attractive is the homicidal puppet, of course.
Yes.
But I'm going to go for C.
You're going to go for C? That she would just pinch people and go, oh, I'm sorry.
Pinch people, Lamb Chop told me to do that.
Yes, and she could not resist. Sadly, it was B. She liked to order lamb chops in restaurants. She said she did that, quote, at every opportunity. You still have two chances here, so we can still win this thing. Perhaps the most widely known cute and lovable character around the world is Hello Kitty, introduced by the Japanese company Sanrio back in 1976. The mouthless kitty cat has appeared in a huge variety of products, including, most recently, which of these? A, the Hello Kitty brand toupee. B, a small, easily concealable Hello Kitty revolver. Or C, crates of contraband Hello Kitty cocaine.
I'm going to go for the concealable revolver.
You're the Hello Kitty concealable revolver.
That's my choice.
I'm afraid it was the cocaine. Just a few weeks ago, Guatemalan police intercepted 1.3 tons of cocaine on its way to Mexico. It was packed in containers, each marked with a smiling Hello Kitty on it.
I wonder if that was probably copyright infringement.
It might be, and I know you're sensitive to that. What was hard about this was we were writing up this question and we were trying to find like two fake things that Hello Kitty has not been on.
It's hard.
It's hard. For example, one of our original ideas was Hello Kitty condoms. They exist.
I don't even want to think about that.
Hello Kitty AK-47.
No.
It exists.
The thought of a Hello Kitty condom just sort of makes my night.
It really does.
Really brings a whole new meaning to Hello Kitty, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Hello Kitty.
I thought it, but I wasn't.
That's not deserved. That joke was just hanging there.
Well, thanks for chopping it down.
You have one more question. Here we go. Get this one right.
I'm hanging by a thread here.
You can do this. Barney the Purple Dinosaur is, of course, a huge hit on children's TV. Has been for years. However, he recently played a key role in world events. What? A, President Bush mentioned to a friend that everything he knew about treating other people he learned from Barney. B, a dispute over the rights to manufacture Barney dolls has led to a violent fight between factory workers in Malaysia. Or C, U.S. soldiers used Barney songs to break the will of prisoners right after the invasion of Iraq.
These all sound very plausible to me, too. Is there anything there about Barney condoms?
No.
Brings a whole new meaning to the concept of a purple dinosaur.
Troops used Barney what's to break the will of...
They used Barney songs. You know, like, I love you, you love me.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Well, I'm going to go for that one. I'm going to go for C.
They used Barney songs to interrogate prisoners. You're right, sir. Well done. Hey. They played Barney songs as well as heavy metal and Sesame Street music at prisoners in order to wear them down. One operative told the BBC, quote, in training, they forced me to listen to the Barney I Love You song for 45 minutes. I never want to go through that again, unquote. Carl, how did Stephen King do on our quiz?
He needed two correct answers to win for Laird and Diane Cantor, but he had just one correct answer, Peter.
Do you have any imaginative ideas for the vengeance you could wreak upon us?
No, all I can do is kind of, you know, guilt trip you and say I did my best.
You did.
That hurts more than anything.
It really does. Stephen King is one of the best-selling authors in the history of letters. His most recent book, as written by the pseudonymous Richard Bachman, is Duma Key. Stephen King, thank you so much for joining us. What a pleasure to have you.
Stephen.
Thank you.
William Safire is one of those people who manages to show up in the middle of things. He arranged the famous kitchen table debate between Nixon and Khrushchev. He went on to write many of Nixon and Spiro Agnew's most famous speeches. And then, of course, he became the premier conservative columnist on the liberal New York Times editorial page. So we had a lot to talk about when he joined us.
Gee, that's a lot of people listening in on a phone call.
I know, it's great.
Yeah, it's like the Bush administration.
Yeah. That goes back to the Nixon administration.
That's true. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned that, of course, your start in politics was as a speechwriter for President Nixon. But prior to that, you arranged the famous Nixon-Khrushchev kitchen debate in Moscow. I guess it was like 1958. Am I getting that date right?
1959, and it was my kitchen.
Yes, that was the thing, that you arranged it not as a representative of Nixon, but...
Right, I was the press agent for the typical American house that was being shown in the American exhibition in Moscow. And Nixon and Khrushchev were walking around, and I managed to get them into my kitchen, and they had their debate there.
I love this, that you're not working for in the kitchen debate between Nixon and Khrushchev. You're not working for Nixon. You're not working for Khrushchev. You're working for the kitchen.
Exactly. And after it was over, Nixon came over to me and said, we really put that kitchen on the map for you, and how'd you like to work on my campaign?
So you did. You worked for Nixon pretty much through the 60s. You left office before he did, if I'm not mistaken.
Just in the nick of time.
In the nick of time. As a speechwriter, your career, you were mostly well-known not so much for what you wrote for the president, but what you wrote for the vice president, Spiro Agnew. And one of your famous contributions to political discourse, as you say in your own dictionary, was his immortal phrase, "nattering nabobs of negativism."
Hey, you got the pronunciation of nabobs correct.
Thank you.
Very few people do that. They all say nabobs, and they're wrong.
No. Apparently, you meant that as a joke, this elaborate alliteration. It wasn't the only alliteration you gave him in that speech.
I gave two to Vice President Agnew. One was the nattering nabobs of negativism. And the other one...
He was describing the media and the elites in the East Coast.
Well, that we were describing the defeatists, the
right.
Prophets of gloom and doom, as
right.
Eisenhower once said. And then I also gave him the hopeless, hysterical hypochondriacs of history.
I don't think that one took off.
No,
it didn't take off because there was an objection from the 4-H clubs.
And justifiably so.
Wow. Now you went off, you left the Nixon White House, you became a conservative op-ed writer for the New York Times.
Right, I was the resident right-winger there.
Yes. And did they always make you sit by yourself at the company picnics, or were you well?
It was a little lonely there for a while, but then I did go to a picnic, and one of the kids for one of the reporters fell in the pool. And my wife, who was standing next to me, pushed me into the pool fully clothed. And so I fished the kid out, and we both came out dripping. And all of a sudden, I was a hero at the picnic. And
Wait a minute. You're telling me that you went to the New York Times, you were a member of the Nixon White House, you were a conservative, they didn't trust you, and then you saved the life of a child in front of the collected staff so they had to accept you?
It was a big break.
Yeah.
And there are some who say that kid did not fall in the pool.
I was about to say.
I've looked at that film over and over
and over. You can see him go back into the left.
I think there's a third Safire at the picnic table.
G. Gordon Liddy pushed the kid.
That's amazing. I had not heard that. That's a great story. Well, William Safire, it is a pleasure to have you here with us. We have asked you here to play a game that this week we are calling...
You're Above the Law, Hard to Kill, Marked for Death, and Out for Justice.
As I'm sure you know, those were the first four films starring action hero, auteur, and martial arts master Steven Seagal. No relation.
The guy with the hair in the back.
The guy with the hair, yeah. Mr. Seagal has finally received his due. Not an Oscar, not yet. But a scholarly book devoted to his oeuvre, titled Seagalology, A Study of the Ass-Kicking Films of Steven Seagal. So we're going to ask you three questions about Mr. Seagal. If you answer two correctly, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is William Sapphire playing for?
He is playing for Aaron Schubel of San Diego, California.
First question. You ready to do this?
You fire away.
All right. First question. Despite his tough exterior, Mr. Seagal is actually a pretty sensitive guy. He was once spotted by a Warner Brothers executive weeping in his trailer. Why did Mr. Seagal say he was crying? Was it A, he was reading the most incredible script he'd ever read in his entire life, which he also just happened to have written? B, he was weeping over the sad fate of the live cultures in his strawberry banana yogurt? Or C, that scene where the mouse gets separated from his family in the animated movie Fievel Goes West always gets to him?
A.
You're going to go for A. He was
absolutely
reading the most incredible script. You're absolutely certain?
Mm-hmm.
You're right. Have you been moved to tears by your own work, sir?
Oh, of course. I completely identified with him in that.
All right. Mr. Seagal did write that script. It was never made into a film, unlike the other scripts he wrote for movies like Shadow Man, Into the Sun, Belly of the Beast. They all came out in theaters. Next question.
I just would love to have seen that moment.
It's so sad. It's like he's a one-man army.
And then he puts his fist right through the guy.
Yeah. He improvises an explosion.
Next question. In addition to being a successful film actor, writer, and director, Mr. Seagal has claimed many other accomplishments, including which of these? A, he is an innovative gourmet chef, the recipient of a Medal of Honor from the French Cordon Bleu Cooking School. B, he is one of the people selected by an elite alien race, he says, to receive their communications on this earth. Or C, he is the reincarnation of an ancient Tibetan Buddhist holy monk.
Well, it can't be A, because the previous one was A, and you wouldn't have two in a row.
You did really well in your SATs, didn't you, sir?
Funny thing, I used to play that game.
All right.
So I would say C.
You're going to go for C. He is the reincarnation of an ancient Tibetan Buddhist holy monk. You're right again. Steven Seagal was recognized by his teacher in Buddhism as a tulku, or reincarnation, of the, quote, 17th century hidden treasure revealer, Kyungbrag Drodre.
There's a Buddhist instructor who knows what side his bread is buttered on.
There you go, you know. So Mr. Seagal has got that going for him. All right. Let's see if we can do this perfectly. We'll turn our attention to the movies themselves. Which of these is a real bit of witty dialogue from a Steven Seagal movie? Is it A, bad guy, you can take that to the bank. Seagal, I'm going to take you to the bank, the blood bank. Is it B, love interest, wow, that was some move you put on that guy. Seagal, I've got another one I want to show you later. It's called the horizontal striking serpent. Or C, chief villain, you have defeated me at every turn. What is it that you want? Seagal, I want to feed you your own small intestine and hear you say, yum.
Well, let's see. We had an A and a C. So I'll pick B.
You're going to pick B out of pure pattern recognition. That's all you're using here. You're going to pick... No, I'm afraid the answer was A, the immortal blood bank exchange that takes place in the movie Hard to Kill from 1990, as I'm sure you, sir, remember. So, Carl, how did William Sapphire do in our show?
Well, enough, Peter. He had two correct answers, so he wins for Aaron Schubel.
Congratulations, sir. Well done.
Well, I'm delighted.
William Sapphire is a veteran columnist for the New York Times. You can read his column on language every Sunday in the magazine. He has also come out with an updated version of his classic, Sapphire's Political Dictionary, now from Oxford Press. William Sapphire, thank you so much for being with us today.
Great.
From NPR and Chicago Public Radio, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Peter Sagal. This week, we are resting on our laurels by reviewing all the cool celebrities we've tricked into coming onto our show. Earlier this year, we went to Santa Barbara, California, north of Los Angeles, and we spoke to one of that colorful city's most colorful denizens, Fannie Flagg, a writer, an actress, and a veteran of some of the more memorable game shows of the 1970s. She began her appearance on our show by revealing a secret.
I want to say to all the ladies over 50 that are on the radio and can't see him, Carl, you're a babe.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I would only say, why over 50, Fanny? So, let's go back. You grew up in Birmingham, Alabama.
I did.
How did a nice girl from Birmingham end up in Southern California in the 60s working on Candid Camera, of all things?
Well, I went to New York when I was very young, when I was 18, and I wanted to be a writer, and I was a writer on that show. And then one day, one of the actresses became had the flu, and so I started acting on it, and I acted and wrote on it because Alan found out he could pay me the same price.
There you go.
There you go. So from there, I started doing the game shows.
So we saw a clip of the old Candid Camera with you on YouTube, and in this particular one, the gag, the thing that's supposed to just totally shock the poor victims of the prank, is the fact that they're flying in an airplane, and their pilot was you.
That's right.
A woman.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, it's just amazing. And I had a little pilot's outfit, and I remember that when the passengers were told, you know, that they were having a female pilot, they were pretty good about it, but the two people that really flipped out were the stewardesses.
Wow.
they said that I won't fly. Wow. They were terrified. So anyhow, but it isn't amazing and isn't it wonderful that at that time that was such a rarity, they thought it was a joke, and now it's really happening.
That's
I'm
amazing.
Thrilled about it.
That's
yeah.
Amazing. Did anybody ever get mad? Because you see the reveal. Now, you're on Candid Camera, Elephant would say. It's
well, you know, it was really the first reality show.
Right.
And people were so delighted to be on television that we rarely, I'll tell you, the only time that people, they didn't get mad, I would watch the man's face and the blood would run out of his face because I would have said, oh, smile, you and your wife are on Candid Camera. And the man standing there would start to absolutely faint, and the young woman with him would sort of back up, and it was not his wife.
Yeah.
No. Now, Fanny, you spent a bunch of years doing different game shows.
Yes, I did.
Back in that period. But the most famous woman, we mentioned your name, people go, oh, yeah, Match Game.
Match Game, yes.
Now, I remember watching Match Game when I was a kid, but I don't know if everybody does. So could you sort of summarize how that worked?
Well, it was just a panel, and you just fill in the blank. And it was sort of like appeal to sixth graders, I suppose.
Yes.
And I was very good at it. But they would say, Mrs. So-and-so was something about her chocolate blank, and people would, you know, fill in the blank. And it was always sort of double entendre.
Yes. It was either sort of breasts behind or making whoopee. Wasn't that euphemism?
Yes, but it was great fun because the panel that we had all liked each other. We had Charles Nelson Reilly, Brett Summers, Richard Dawson, and we just had a great time. And it was a great thing to film because we did five shows in one day, and they would take a big lunch break. And the lunch would be sort of a liquid lunch.
Sure.
And so when they would come back after the third show, we'd look up and Charles's wig was just a little to the right.
I always thought the show was best on Fridays.
Yes.
Now you know why.
So, and then somehow you made the transition from performer and game show bon vivant to novelist.
Yes, I wanted to be a writer, and I made the transition because actually it had to do with Santa Barbara. I moved to Santa Barbara in 1975. I was came to Los Angeles, and I was there for about a week, and didn't like it because I couldn't find my way around. And I came up to Santa Barbara, California for lunch, and absolutely fell in love with it and never went back, stayed here the whole time. I didn't even send for my clothes. And Santa Barbara is the most beautiful, the people, the friendliest, the most beautiful. The weather is fantastic.
All right. The weather is perfect. The climate is beautiful. The mountains are beautiful. The ocean is here. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with it? Because there's got to be something wrong with it. I'm from New Jersey. I'm always looking at for the flaw. Where are the bodies buried? What's...
In New Jersey.
Yeah, I guess so. That's where they came from. Well, Fanny Flagg, we are so delighted to have you with us. We've asked you here to play a game we're calling...
Could I have a guacamole bacon $6 burger, please, a large chocolate milkshake, and a moment of silence for a great American?
That great American would be Carl Karcher, the founder of the Carl's Jr. hamburger chain. He died in January, just a few days shy of his 91st birthday. As a tribute to this innovator in cholesterol delivery technology, we're going to ask you three questions about Carl's Jr. restaurants. Get two right, you'll win our prize. For one of our listeners, Carl's voice in their home answering machine. Carl, who is Fanny Flagg playing for?
Fanny is playing for Karen Ikegami of Seattle, Washington.
All right. Here's your first question. For a long time, Carl's Jr. was just a West Coast-based hamburger chain, consistently placed third in sales out here behind McDonald's and Burger King. But then the company decided they needed to throw off that dowdy image. As a promotional stunt in 2006, the chain added what to its menu at one of its restaurants? Was it A, the entire cow burger, a 10-meter-wide burger using all the meat from a single Texas-raised black Angus steer? B, the $6,000 combo meal consisting of a burger, fries, and a $6,000 bottle of Bordeaux? Or C, the 3,000-calorie cheese-filled chili potato guiso burger, about which no more need be said?
I think I'm going to go with the one with the Bordeaux.
The Bordeaux, the $6,000 combo meal?
Yeah.
Burger, fries, $6,000 bottle of wine?
Uh-huh.
You're right.
Wow.
Very good. It was offered only at the Carl's Branch in the Palms Casino in Las Vegas.
Whoa.
I don't know if anybody went for it. Second question. The company also tried to spice up their ads and their celebrity spokespeople. One Carl's Jr. TV ad aired in the 1990s showed who enjoying a Carl's Jr. burger. Was it A, famed Hollywood madam Heidi Fleiss, B, disgraced junk bond king and felon Michael Milken, or C, one of basketball player Dennis Rodman's many tattoos?
Oh, mercy. I think I'm going to say, I know this sounds peculiar, one of his tattoos.
One of Dennis Rodman's tattoos?
Yes.
You're right again.
Oh, my heavens.
That was well done.
I tell you, boy, eating vegan's good for the brain.
Exactly. The animated commercial showed a star in his scalp coming to life and enjoying a burger.
Whoa.
Which is such a disturbing thought, I want to move on. Now, by far the most controversial Carl's Jr. commercial ever was one from just a few years ago with socialite and amateur porn star Paris Hilton seemingly attempting to copulate with a luxury automobile while washing it before biting down on a burger and calling it, quote, hot. People were outraged. There was a backlash by parents groups, etc. What did Carl's Jr. CEO Andrew Puzder say in response to the critical outcry? Did he say, A, quote, we want to assure the burger-buying public that there is little to no chance you will ever encounter Miss Hilton in a Carl's Jr. restaurant, unquote. B, quote, I don't know. I find a beautiful woman washing a car much less creepy than that clown who's always hanging around with those kids. Or C, quote, get a life.
Oh, it's either, it's, I think it's either get a life or the creepy clown, and it's just too funny. And even if I'm wrong, I have to go with the creepy clown.
Creepy clown?
Yeah.
Sad it was get a life, I'm
afraid. Oh!
But he did go on to say, quote, this isn't Janet Jackson. There's no nipple in this. There is no nudity. There are no sex acts. It's a beautiful model in a swimsuit washing a car. Carl, how did Fanny Flagg do in our quiz?
Fanny had two correct answers, Peter, so she wins our prize for Karen.
Well done.
Coming.
Fanny Flagg is a beloved author of Fried Green Tomatoes and many other works. She's been an actress, a game show star. She is a proud resident of Santa Barbara, California. Fanny Flagg, thank you so much for joining us today. On our show, we make fun of politicians. Perhaps because they know this, they often hire people to speak for them. On our show, we have hosted three of President Bush's press secretaries, but we definitely were most excited to speak to Scott McClellan, not only because he had been so much fun to watch on the podium, but because he had just publicly condemned his former boss. Even so, though, the first thing we wanted to know was,
Did the president and vice president ever, you know, listen to our show?
I don't know about the vice president.
No, I guess not. We used to, around our office, we used to obsessively watch your press conferences. And the thing that always amazed us was that no matter what the reporters threw at you, how hostile the questioning got, and sometimes it did get hostile, you would never lose your cool, you would never get mad, you would never get upset. It was really impressive. And then we've read your book, and even though you report on some things that were, well, upsetting in terms of how you were misled in certain areas, you still don't seem to be that upset about it.
I think that's what happens when you're the youngest of four and you got three older brothers. You learn just to take it and move on and not worry about it too much. But
really?
Anytime I think you saw me smile, you knew I was thinking, what a stupid question. I just couldn't say it out loud.
Really? So that smile when you were seeming so pleasant and patient was really that?
Exactly.
Are you smiling now? So here's the question. What does get you mad?
Boy, it's hard to think about that. When the University of Texas loses a football game, I get pretty upset, but that's about it.
Really? Gosh, nothing else? Not the whole Iraq war propaganda thing? That's okay, but... Scooter Libby lying to you? No problem, but when the Longhorns go down...
That's right.
Well, you have talked about a lot of those things in your prior interviews. We wanted to get at some other things that we have discussed about the White House. Just get the inside story from someone who was there and apparently has already burnt his bridges, so you might as well tell the truth. You may remember the incident in which President Bush supposedly choked on a pretzel and passed out.
Yes.
What really happened, Scott?
We don't know. No one was actually there.
And, really?
And, it was just himself and in the White House residence.
And so he came out of the residence. He had some sort of black eye or injury.
That's right. He hit his. I think he fell and hit himself on the table after he choked on the pretzel and passed out.
And you're telling me that no one was in the room with him. He said, "Oh, I choked on a pretzel and I fell over."
That's the story.
And you all said, "Yes, Mr. President."
I don't think you can make that one up.
He couldn't make that up, maybe, but do you... All right, but as far as you know, that's what happened. You have no evidence, nothing...
That's correct.
All right.
Did he have a nickname for you?
My nickname was just Scotty. That's all he had for me. Nothing fancy.
Do you think you have a nickname now?
I don't think I can say it over the airwaves.
No, I guess not. And we have to ask you about this. And this is, of course, the famous statement that President Bush made as you left the White House on that day back in 06. He said, you know, someday Scott and I will be sitting back on the porch in Texas in our rocking chairs and talking about the good old days. So is that date still in your calendar?
I think we'll be sitting on different porches in different places.
Well, Scott McClellan, it is a pleasure to finally talk to you in person as opposed to simply talking about you. And we have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
You're a diminutive gay alcoholic genius and gossip addict.
Since your job in the Bush White House was mostly keeping your mouth shut, we thought we'd ask you three questions about somebody who couldn't stay quiet if his life depended on it. That would be writer Truman Capote, a lifelong gossip and dealer in high society dish.
Scott, just one thing, okay? These are the real questions. You can't come back in 3 years and give us the real answer.
All right. Answer two out of three questions about Truman Capote, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is Scott McClellan playing for?
Scott is playing for Andy Finley of Spring Hill, Tennessee.
Here, sir, is your first question about Truman Capote. He loved gossip. One could say it was his true profession. He came up with actual gossip competitions, such as which of these? A version of the basketball game horse, if player one described, say, an intimate detail of a celebrity's anatomy, player two had to do the same thing or lose a point. Was it B? He liked to take two disparate people and then try to connect them by shared sexual partners. Or C, everybody in the room takes a drink and holds it, and then the player tries to come up with something so shocking but true that the other players spit their drinks out.
I, You know, the one that sounds most interesting to me is the one I think I'll go with. They always say go with your first instincts, right?
Right.
I'll go with B.
You're going to go with B, the sexual linkage between two disparate people. That's your choice?
That's my choice.
You're right, sir. Very well done. He called the game IDC for International Daisy Chain. And he claimed to have once connected Cab Calloway, the band leader, to Adolf Hitler via a mere 3 bedmates.
So,
wow.
That's impressive. Don't know how he did that. All right, next question. Truman Capote was known for his insults. Famously, he once said of Jack Kerouac's book, On the Road, quote, "That's not writing, that's typing." How did he once describe the writer Lillian Hellman? Did he say, A, quote, "like George Washington in drag"? B, quote, "like a dog in every way, except the good ones"? Or C, quote, "somebody who wouldn't spill her cheap wine on you if you were on fire"? And I'm sparing you my Truman Capote impersonation. I just want you to know.
Let's go with A.
You're going to go with A, George Washington in drag. For a circumspect guy, you're pretty good at this stuff. Yes, that
did
was
I get
what
it?
You did. That's what he said. All right, let's see if you can do this perfectly, because I will be impressed if you can. Sometimes Truman Capote made people upset. For example, when Saul Bellow won the Nobel Prize for Literature, Capote said he didn't think Bellow deserved it. How did Saul Bellow, Nobel laureate, reply? Did he say, A, quote, "maybe Truman could win a little something for himself if he ever actually wrote something"? B, quote, "I can't see what Truman deserves at all except a kick in the ass"? Or C, "Truman? Truman Capote? Is he still alive?"
I will go with B.
B. You're going to go with B. "I can't see what Truman deserves at all except a kick in the ass"?
Yeah, I'll go with B.
You're right.
Wow.
Carl, how did Scott McClellan do in our quiz?
Scott was perfect, Peter. 3 correct answers, so he wins for Andy Finley. Congratulations, Scott.
Very well done.
Thank you.
White House press spokesman Scott McClellan has a book out. It is called What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. It's available everywhere. Scott McClellan, thank you so much for being with us today. What a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed it.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the members of the National Association of Realtors working on behalf of America's residential and commercial property owners on the web at Realtor.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, examining the paths to opportunity in a new report from its Economic Mobility Project at pewtrusts.org. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and Chicago Public Radio in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, executive producer. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is directed by Melody Kramer and produced by Emily Ecton. The senior producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle. Thanks as well to Neil Patrick Harris, Stephen King, William Sapphire, Fanny Flagg, and Scott McClellan, all our panelists, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Peter Sagal, and we will see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.